I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers. The Rance Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated. Welcome back, listeners. So last week we had Darren with his X-Files.
Yeah.
This week...
Well, we had mostly you in terms of audio.
The audio.
But I'm
so
here.
Sad.
Hey, I'm here,
you
everybody.
You did all the research. You went to the library and everything.
Oh, God. It was fucking heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking. And then salvaging what I could, I'm still, kind of distraught over it all.
The second half sounded great.
Thanks.
Yeah. But this week, it's my turn, and I'm so excited because it's the Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode.
Yeah, we've been sort of teasing this idea for a long time.
I've been trying to make it happen. Trying. I'm like slowly getting my way here. For me, Buffy is just one of those shows that I covet it, but I also want to share it with people. Mm-hmm. It's like my baby, and I want to convert people like to it, like a religion. And I think that is kind of how like people who are into Buffy are.
There's got to be a website, The Cult of Buffy.
Yeah.
There must be.
Who are you?
I'm Buffy, the vampire slayer, and you are?
So what I love about Buffy is that I can still remember the first time I watched an episode, and my aunt had actually VHS taped a few episodes and sent them to us, like in the mail.
That's love. That's real love.
That is kind of how that went, because we didn't have cable or the WB, which was part, apparently, of cable. And I remember like the first time I saw Angel, and I thought he was so cool.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was like brooding and mysterious and so totally hot. But like, at that point in time, I wish like me now would be like, that guy was such a loser.
Just hold on for Spike.
Yeah, exactly. Angel's like the worst thing ever. I hate Angel, and I hate people who like Buffy and Angel together. I said it. There. Whatever. Obviously, Spike is the best for Buffy. Spuffy forever.
Is that, that's a shipper relationship?
Yeah.
Spuffy?
Spuffy. Spike and Buffy.
Gotcha.
What else would it be? Bike. Bike is terrible.
Bikey.
Well, that's kind of cuter. Buffy the Vampire spans from 1997 until its seventh season, where it ends in 2003. And Buffy was a weekly institution for me through junior high and through high school. And it was the way to dress and the way to talk. For a little girl from a farm, Buffy was like everything I wanted to be. She was funny, and she was a badass, and she was an awesome dresser, and she had really great hair. The show's set in Sunnydale, which is conveniently set on the Hellmouth, which is lucky for the set designers that they chose the California Hellmouth and not, like, the Cleveland Hellmouth.
Okay.
Because that would be boring.
Later, there is a Cleveland Hellmouth?
There's more Hellmouths.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, gotcha. One of them happens to be in Cleveland, which it would have been tough to film in L.A. like that, you know? Buffy was a who's who of 90s musicians, not only on the soundtrack, but also the guest bands that played at the Bronze, which was the cool place, even though high schoolers hung out, which means that was totally not cool.
Like the Peach Pit.
Yeah, exactly. And one of my favorite cameos was, it's so 90s, Amy Mann was there, Michelle Branch was there, and at a party one time, Biff Naked played. Do you remember Biff Naked? She was so cool. She
had
tattoos.
Oh, it's a lady. I don't remember Biff Naked.
Yeah, she was at a frat party and she played once. Along with the musicians, it was a who's who of writers and directors. Skipping the obvious Joss Whedon for now, we have Jane Evanson from Battlestar Galactica, David Fury from Hannibal, and Drew Goddard, who wrote Cloverfield and directed one of your favorites, Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah.
At the helm of this writing staff, the leader of Mutant Enemy Productions is Joss Whedon.
So I remember Joss Whedon's name coming up as a writer on the show Roseanne, which was like my family's go-to.
Which I didn't know that. I love Roseanne.
Yeah. It was a great show, and a bunch of great writers went through there. Judd Apatow just being one of them, but Joss Whedon as well. And apparently, guy comes from a long lineage of writers. His mother was a novelist going by the name Lee Whedon. She was also a history teacher. And both his father, Tom Whedon, and his grandfather, John Whedon, were successful television writers. I think his grandfather might have written on Leave It to Beaver.
Oh, wow.
That far back. So of all his work, like, I'm a Firefly guy. I think it is a little bit of a boys' club. I get that. But as far as Joss Whedon's work, like you mentioned, Cabin in the Woods is seminal. It's such a good flick. But I did take notice that as far as like his female protagonist, he talks a lot about Kitty Pryde from the X-Men, Shadowcat, and how Buffy is even sort of inspired by her. In 2004, he was writing the comic series The Astonishing X-Men, which is kind of like a return to form from the like slick black leather uniforms from the movies, and that found its way into the comics. And he was like, let's bring this back to like the traditional fun comic book style storytelling. And that was a great series, and Kitty Pryde was the featured character.
I always loved her. She was my favorite.
Eventually she's got Lockheed.
I didn't hate the sidekick. People hated that little guy.
That'll put marzipan in your pie plate, bingo.
Okay, just as a small gripe on my point, we did discover that the X-Files and also Buffy had been taken off Netflix. And
I know.
That you were in the routine of watching Buffy in the mornings as you got ready for work.
Right. I mean, probably when I got done with Cheers, I would have gone back to Buffy.
Start from the beginning for 7 seasons total?
Seven seasons total.
That's pretty solid. Yeah. And they're pretty long seasons. They're like traditional TV long seasons. And that'll come into play when I'm sort of talking about stories and stuff. But I don't know. I grew pretty frustrated watching these on Hulu. It's been a while since I've been forced to watch those many commercials.
Oh, yeah, see, I might have the free 1 month Hulu that might get canceled.
The premium.
Yeah.
The premium, the good stuff.
Mm-hmm, the good stuff with no can. Yeah, I can't watch commercials. I'm not a savage. So like our X-Files episode, we did some Monster of the Week episodes.
Yeah.
You let me pretty much choose. I gave you some options. You chose not the musical.
I did watch it. I watched it twice. So like as a reference point, I've got that.
Oh, I thought you didn't even want to watch it. So I was like, I guess he hates musicals.
I don't. I actually really enjoy Joss Whedon's Dr. Horrible's sing-along
blog. Yeah, that's great. That's fun.
Yeah, it's terrific.
So I chose three. First one I started off is because it's got a face that everyone loves to see in films. It's John Ritter's episode called Ted.
I'm very fond of your mother, I guess. That's pretty obvious. I know you're the most important thing in her life, and, well, gosh, that makes you pretty important to me, too.
Buffy, I really want you to be okay with this.
Beg to differ. We really want you to be okay with this.
It's episode 11 from the second season. And you have to think about this. It's hard sometimes to watch Buffy in singular little episodes.
I did find that.
Because even though it's Monster of the Week, there is a very strong arc for every single season and for the entire series. Yeah. So there's a lot kind of going on.
Joss Whedon is definitely a planner. He's got a season in mind. And so when the show sort of found its natural finish and they wanted him to keep going, that presents a challenge.
Right. So he did. He continued on with the comic book, and we had season 8 that he wrote, and then 9, 10, and 11 also came out. But here in season 2, we have Ted, written by David Greenwalt, who, okay, do you remember me ever telling you that one time there was an old Fox show that a guy slept in a box? He was like a businessman by day, and then he would sleep in a box at night.
What more was there to that story? That doesn't sound like enough for a TV show.
Oh, he also told you how to beat a lie detector test by stabbing yourself with tacks in your shoes. He would do that too. But anyway, it was a thing I never could remember what it was. It was like Pretender era TV, and I could not figure it out. Well, David Greenwald actually developed the show that I am always thinking of, and it was called Profit, by the way.
Okay.
So I didn't dream that TV show up, and I was very excited to find that out, honestly. Written by him and also Joss Whedon, directed by Bruce Seth Green, who you see in these credits a lot on Buffy. The main premise here is that Buffy's mother is a divorced single mother. She meets this new dream boyfriend, who is John Ritter, and he's too good to be true.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's not like exactly dreamy. He's got a little bit of paunch, a little bit of a mullet. I mean, he's an American treasure, don't get
me
wrong.
Exactly. And he's a great cook, and he's funny, and he says all the right things.
I like my new 9-gig hard drive.
But you don't love it, because without the DMA upgrade, your computer's only half a rocket ship.
Yeah, but who can afford the upgrades?
Well, you can. I get the demos for free. I don't see why I shouldn't give them to you for the same price. Any friend of Buffy's? What?
That's the sound she makes when she speaks us with geeker joy.
He wins Willow over with computer disc upgrades. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, he hands her a stack of like the 3.5-inch discs, yeah. which I'm guessing there was like an operating system hack on there by the language they were using.
Yeah, but I didn't know. He could have been handing her AOL CDs for all I know. I was like, those are free at the grocery store. Don't be stupid. Buffy discovers this whole relationship when she walks in on her mom and Ted making out.
Yeah. Yeah. And this sounds like the first relationship her mom has had since the divorce. So Buffy's naturally resistant and skeptical. And then when John Ritter presents, well, when Ted presents as too good to be true, she, you know, she doesn't want to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Exactly.
Okay, so I've got a wardrobe alarm for overalls because I remember, I mean, I was a teenager in the 90s and this was a little past, well, this is a couple years past like crisscross where overalls really were at their peak.
This is 97, so yeah.
So like overalls, if you wanted to be really risque, you take off one strap and just rock one strap on the overalls.
Of course you did. We called them bibs, by the way.
Bibs?
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds more like a farm town kind of...
Yeah, we always called them bibs.
Yeah, in New Jersey, we were just rocking the bibs for just aesthetic purposes. There was not like a work function to any of our overalls.
And if you were a girl, you would wear like a crop top.
Okay, and show some midriff.
Exactly. That was very cool to do.
I also noticed that Xander, I'll get into Xander more later, but I think he was wearing JNCOs or some equivalent circus tent size jeans.
He's wearing some large pants.
I'm puzzled how we didn't run through like a denim shortage in the 90s.
The fashion in Buffy looks, it's pretty much the thing that dates it so badly, honestly. But the fashion was so 90s and I loved it. If you wanted to know how I dressed, that was how I dressed.
I was thinking how, and this is a weird pull, but Steven Spielberg replaced all the guns in E.T. with walkie-talkies to make it look like less threatening so kids could watch it comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like, well, that's bullshit. They shouldn't do that kind of stuff. However, if they were to digitally tweak people's wardrobes from that time, some of these shows and movies might age better.
It's true. Buffy rocks a boot cut like nobody's business.
Buff, you're lacking evidence. I think maybe we're in Sigmund Freud territory.
He has a point. Separation anxiety, the mother figure being taken away, conflict with the father figure.
He's not my father figure.
Having issues much?
I am not.
You're having parental issues. You're having parental issues.
Xander.
What? Freud would have said the exact same thing. Except he might not have done that little dance.
So Ted and Buffy's mom, I mean, we meet them when they're first making out, mm-hmm. and we find that he is not, I'll only say that he is not human, he is other, and I mean, by the midway of the show, they were probably intimate, at which point I'm wondering, like,
Well, he was too good to be true. He was good at everything that he could do.
It's like, I've been out of the dating game for a long time. Do men's dicks vibrate these days?
Oh, maybe. Maybe that's what she was thinking. It had been quite a while. When we start to find out, because it seems for the whole thing, they're gaslighting Buffy and saying, like, you're the one with the problem. And we find out that actually Ted does suck at a mini golf course. And I will tell you, family events to a mini golf course do always sort of end like that.
It's like a Monopoly game. It's like eventually everyone's patience is just
Someone gets mad, someone cheats, someone calls someone out for cheating. That's just the way it goes.
But that's the point where this episode kind of finds its subtext, where Buffy is the only one to get a glimpse at mm-hmm. John Ritter's dark side. And because she sort of started off as the girl who cried wolf, like no one's really listening to her. Her mom is not receptive to Buffy having issues with him. And so that starts to like become this interesting angle in terms of, you know, scenarios with parental abuse where a kid, you know, is resistant to speaking up. And when they finally do, no one believes them.
Mm-hmm.
And so like Buffy finds herself in this corner that, you know, she never wants to be on the other side away from her mom.
Exactly.
And here Ted is standing between them.
It's really interesting because what you find out when you watch kind of the entire episode, we don't know that yet. Let's say even we had watched every single episode up to this episode, we still don't know. When he says he finds her diary and discovers that she's this slayer, but he doesn't believe it. and he threatens to have her locked up in a mental institution. Mm. And that's terrifying to Buffy because they did that to Buffy when Joyce and Buffy's father were together. Oh. They put her in an institution. So we find that years later out. So watching it, rewatching it, you're like, dang, that's why Buffy doesn't speak up.
Right, right. Wow.
Because it's a real legitimate threat.
Yeah, and then calling back to the point that, like, Joss Whedon had outlined these stories and these story arcs, so, like, mm-hmm. calling back to a note from a previous season, nicely done.
Exactly. Yeah. It's one of those things where the universe that Joss Whedon creates here with Buffy is so nice. It's so congruent compared to X-Files, where they kind of change their mind every episode.
Yeah, there's episode. Too many cooks in that kitchen. And like, occasionally you get a standout cook. But yeah, the guy, I mean, Chris Carter, is no Joss Whedon.
Right. But to see this, like, you know, call back that you don't even know is there.
Right, right. I didn't know.
It's pretty brilliant. It's pretty great. We have a few things going on with the storyline, too. In season two, you always forget once you go through. Like, it's always when I come back and I rewatch things, I go, oh, yeah, I forgot. But Cordelia and Xander are together secretly.
And that's
a very nice thing. Willow is still
for Xander.
Geeky Willow.
For Cordelia, she's with the loser.
Yeah, it's true. But she really does love him.
God knows why.
We also have Giles and Miss Callender, who, because of some angel shenanigans previously, that's why they're fighting. Because I didn't know when you were watching it, were you confused by certain things, or did you just go, ah, fuck it?
I was going with it. There's a later episode that I watched, the one that followed. I watched the episode following Hush to sort of give myself some context. But in this case, like, I was just kind of figured, like, yeah, there's drama. Giles is, of course, like, leading a double life is going to make it difficult to maintain a relationship.
I mean, Miss Callender knows what's up, but there's, like, this whole thing with her, and I'm glad when that's all ended and over. And then Angel is here because he's recuperating and Buffy's, like, taking care of him in this weird sort of platonic, not platonic kind of way.
I do love that the episode is just named Ted, and mm-hmm. John Ritter is just Ted. Like, at this point, Buffy has fought demons from the, like, furthest reaches of hell and vampires older than this country, and then we face Ted.
Yeah.
he's just perfectly mundane. I love John Ritter.
He's really good in this because when he turns on the bad guy.
Hey, how about that? Got a hole in two.
Beg to differ.
Okay, so find my score or whatever.
I think you're missing the point here, little lady. Right is right, wrong is wrong. Why don't people see that?
It's just a game.
Right, it's just a game, do your own thing. Well, I'm not wired that way. And I'm here to tell you, it is not a game. It does count, and I don't stand for that kind of malarkey in my house.
Yeah, it's fucking creepy.
It's pretty great. And the whole reveal is also very nice.
There's I won't give it away, but the special effects specific to him were so good. Mm-hmm. Were so good. I wanted to see more, and then they just kind of give you a peek, and yeah, it was great. I'm going to talk about the villains a little bit later, but in this case, like, it was a great setup. I wanted more. He left me wanting more. I feel like sometimes the structure, more often than not, the shows have an A, B, and C plot, and so we don't get very deep into some of the more interesting story ideas. I get it, like I just said, leave them wanting more, but you know, for the occasional viewer who isn't collecting the entire series and keeping track of everything, it's a little frustrating, especially in terms of the villains, where, you know, as it relates to comic books, they talk about a hero's kind of defined by his villains, and so they're only as good as their villains. And in this case, like, Buffy's got great villains. We just don't spend very much time with them.
Right.
And so I was a little frustrated. I kind of wanted more from the bad guys and the shows that we're going to talk
that.
About.
I could see that. And there is this feeling when you watch just maybe episodes out of order and not the whole thing, there's a feeling of an inside joke that you're not a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be tough.
Yeah.
You know,
it makes it a little tough to pick up the show. You know, right. And especially in the 90s, you didn't have the option of starting from the beginning. You'd have to pick up, you know.
Exactly.
A shoebox full of VHS tapes.
Right. My aunt was sending me VHS tapes of it when it was on the WB.
Right. And before that, it was, well, no, I guess it was later. It was like the CW.
It became CW,
after it merged,
which is now, and they, you know, teen it's like Buffy really kind of set off the CW for what it is today.
Right. So speaking of villains I wanted to spend a lot more time with, we've got season 4's episode 10, Hush.
Yeah. Can't do an episode like a Monster of the Week without this episode.
Yeah, this is brilliant. So we're cutting to Buffy in college, and I do like that it's kind of like Saved by the Bell, the college years, where everybody is essentially living in the same house, if not like neighborhood. I was a little confused as far as like how many of these people are residents and how many people are just visiting.
Well, you see Sunnydale is still in Sunnydale. That's right, the college. Right. So Giles lives in an apartment complex. It seems very fancy. And, you know, Buffy's mom still lives on Ravello Drive. And so the girls live at the dorms. Xander lives at his parents' house.
Right. Willow's definitely in the dorms.
Yeah. Well, she lives with Buffy after Buffy got rid of her first roommate, who was a demon.
Ah, okay. So when everyone in Sunnydale loses their voice, the Scooby Gang, a.k.a. Buffy's crew, must silently solve the mystery of the monsters who stole their ability to speak.
Yeah.
And those villains are the Gentlemen.
I love them. They scare me so much.
It's a great character design. I think it informs so many things. We've talked about the Slender Man a lot on the show. And so this is a good 10 years before even the origin point of the Slender Man. Here we have like tall, lanky, bald figures who kind of hover and don't speak.
Right.
And let's see. So leading your pack, we've got the physically gifted Doug Jones.
Yeah.
I like to think he's kind of America's Javier Botet.
I liked when you wrote that in your notes. I was like, yes, he is.
Yeah, there's only a 3-inch difference, but Javier Botet's a 6'6". Doug Jones
have
only 6'3".
Have they ever been in the same movie?
I don't know, but considering how much Doug Jones works with Guillermo del Toro, I want to see it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people would know Doug Jones from any number of roles, a lot of which he's under deep makeup effects, like Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies, or Fauno, and he also played the Pale Man in Pan's Labyrinth. Incidentally, he's in Guillermo del Toro's next movie that's coming out, I think later in the year, The Shape of Water, where he plays essentially the creature from the Black Lagoon as sort of prisoner and being studied by the American government. And there's a mute woman who sort of, you know, doesn't discover him. She's forced to work in that department, and they develop a relationship, but there's a lot of sign language. And I was thinking how much of that movie must take place in silence. I was thinking in terms of the Gentlemen in this show, their first like group reveal, they're very like gentle, subtle hand gestures that they make.
Yeah, like Fosse style hands.
And at first glance, I thought it was sign language. And I was thinking like, wow, like a silent villain who speaks in sign language, like that's some great like quiet assassin stuff.
Yeah.
So it doesn't quite go there. These guys are more, I guess, telepathically communicating, but they do creepily hover about a foot over the ground, and they are sort of always following behind the footmen, who are these like spastic sociopathic guys who are like bandaged face and straight jackets with the arms extended. And so they are the exact opposite of the Gentlemen in terms of being like this kinetic nightmare.
Right. And the only thing you can kind of hear.
So the Gentlemen move slowly and deliberately, hovering. And that floating effect was done in two different ways, depending on the framing of the shots. They were either suspended from cranes with wires that were later removed in post, or they were pulled by dollies. That in conjunction with, like we talked about, their sort of mannerisms being these like very, very smooth. I guess a lot of the actors, Doug Jones is a brilliant like physical actor, and his cohorts in that case, a lot were mimes. Mm-hmm. So like just like physically gifted actors who were sort of, you know, they sort of decided on a body language, and so they're not just hovering, but they are sort of like very gesture. I'm doing it for Mindy. I'm sort of slowly, I'm pivoting in my seat like they would. But it's so eerie. It's such a great aesthetic, and that all of this is paired with this rictus grin, this terrifying Joker-style perma-grin that they're wearing. And if you pay close attention, some of the background guys have like a fixed smile that's immovable. Doug Jones and I think his sort of co-lead were sort of left to do it on their own. So I don't know. He managed to hold a smile the way like Hannibal Lecter holds eye contact.
Because if you look closely, each one has a different personality and a different face. It's not the same like prosthetic on every single one. Everyone has their own like style and smile and thing. And it's so creepy and it's excellent, excellent work to see Doug Jones on this and how they choose and do not choose certain victims is excellent because it is almost like a telepathic communication.
Yeah.
This all leads up to probably the best scene, the funniest scene, I guess. That's what I would say. The funniest scene of the whole series, which features our theme song.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You're welcome, Giles. Thank you.
Yeah, when Giles is presenting to the group, like, I mean, you sort of, you come to the point where everybody needs to know what Giles knows because he's been doing the research and he finally figures out who these guys are. And so, like, giving a presentation to a group of people without using a single word, you go to the old 90s overhead projector.
Of course you do. And your vis-a-vis markers, right? And it's awesome. Great drawings by whoever drew those up, which I assume is Joss Whedon.
It
very
did
nice.
Look like the Mutant Enemy logo. Yeah.
That's what I assume. But there's some great back and forth with absolutely no speaking. They want to find out what they want, and Willow points to her chest at one time and Xander mounts boobies, and it's so funny. I laughed out loud, and I've watched this now like 3 times in preparation for this episode, and every time I laugh out loud.
They get away with quite a bit. Actually, come to think of it, there are a couple things that I wonder if they would be able to get away with them on TV now, but between like the jerk off gesture that Buffy is making, where she's actually implying the stake, but between that, later in the episode, Spike. No, I guess it was
before
that. He flips
Xander off.
Yeah, but like in the English style, where it's the peace sign backwards. Yeah, there are a couple like pretty risque things that, I mean, they were forced to do on account of the challenge of not using dialogue, and apparently Joss Whedon was kind of deliberately moving towards that I guess he might have taken some criticism that like your show is a whole lot of gabbing but no substance or whatever the complaint was. And
well,
he was
that's
like,
a stupid complaint.
Like, I'll show you. I'll do a whole show with no talking at all.
We don't even have to talk.
Yeah.
No, it's a great show. There's something to point out. This was a totally 90s problem or like late 90s, early 2000s problem. Tara is wearing a really long like canvas or denim skirt that she probably bought at Delia's, okay? If I had to place a store that she bought it at. And she's trying to run away from the gentleman and she falls. And I will tell you, running in those 90s long skirts was very difficult.
Yeah, come to think of it,
there's like very little ventilation to you and your legs are kind of tight and you're kind of hobble. It's almost like a hobble. And you're just running. It's very difficult. So I was happy to see that she fell down and kept it real.
No actual witches in your witch group?
No, bunch of wanna-blessed beings.
You know, nowadays every girl with a henna tattoo and a spice rack thinks she's a sister to the dark ones.
I did love hers and Willow's story. At this point, Willow is sort of trying to figure out more of her sort of witchcraft,
life,
I suppose.
Life and life after Oz.
I think I'm probably just predisposed to like Allison Hannigan. That's just, that's on me. But yeah, no, I love that as the like B story to this particular story. I thought her and Tara coming together was a really nice bit where, yeah, they sort of find their strength together.
It is. It's not the first time we see Tara, but it's the first time now that Allison and Tara know Allison. Like I know her. Like I just have to like, my friend there. But Willow and Tara actually use magic together, or Willow uses magic in front of anyone besides the Scooby gang. So that's kind of monumental kind of thinking there. A few other notes, if you're just watching this one out of touch, why do you think Spike might be hanging around with them?
Well, I've already, I mean,
oh, you cheated.
Over the years of, I mean, I've absorbed a certain amount just, you know,
like from
you and elsewhere. For those listening, you should check out our rant sequitur where Mindy talks about Star Wars. But so I do know a good bit about Spike. I don't know if I... Yeah, okay. So I know that he has got a cerebral chip.
Yes.
I'm presuming in his head.
Yes.
But it stops him from hurting humans.
Okay.
And so I don't love that as a plot device, but I'm going with it. I meant to ask you... what the appeal of, I mean, he's a very handsome guy.
Yeah, he's very handsome.
But I don't dig the Billy Idol hair. I don't think it works especially
well for
him. Firstly,
Billy Idol stole that from him, which is addressed later on in the show.
Okay. In this fictional reality, not in a DeLorean time machine kind of way.
I don't know. It's just, well, firstly, you have to also transport yourself back to the late 90s. Bleach blonde hair was very cool.
It was pretty
very
big.
Cool. Remember when Pacey did that for that Cruel Intentions movie and he looked very cool?
Okay.
I just said a bunch of 90s things just now. 90s are my jam. He's very handsome. What do you mean? He's cool and he's handsome and he smokes cigarettes, which is bad in real life, but kind of cool looking. And he's like a blonde kind of Cillian Murphy. What's not to like?
All right.
And he's got the accent and he's like badass.
The accent goes a long way. The accent does go a long way. I was going to say, I did find on Buffypedia, after his run on Angel, and after a slew of adventures, Spike reunited with Buffy and the gang in Europe and joined them in a battle against Twilight. I wasn't sure if that was a joke or if that happens in the comic.
It happens in the comics.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it happens in the comics. Spike goes through this whole thing. Anyway, they all get back together again. Buffy and Spike, not in the same way that they are in the series, but as colleagues later on.
Okay. Okay, as a complete non-sequitur, I was going to ask you, does Christy Swanson ever play a part in the show?
No.
Does she ever appear? No.
No,
the original
she
Buffy?
She should, though. That would never be cute, but
yeah, I thought she'd be like the cool aunt.
Oh, that would be cool, but no, there's no, yeah. No aunt.
Missed opportunity, or maybe a contractual thing. I don't know. The original Buffy is not allowed in this show.
then it's like if you meet yourself in another reality, you can't do it.
Yeah. Actually, come to think of it, Joss Whedon was not happy with the feature film, the original script that he wrote for that film.
I don't love that film either.
It's been years since I saw it. I love Paul Rubens.
I do too.
That I remember fondly.
And I used to think Pike was like so cool, but he's not. When you rewatch some of the stuff from the 90s, people are not nearly as cool as you thought they were. But Spike is still cool.
Our teenage bar was much lower.
That's true. So sad. So the last monster of the week is a big one for monsters, but it's a really big one for the storyline and the way the story starts to change. And it really leads into your fifth season and gives us what we get in the sixth season, starting off with fifth season premiere, Buffy versus Dracula.
You think you know what you are, what's to come. You haven't even begun.
Yeah, after watching the episode, I kind of wondered if this was kind of a studio note where people were asking, like, when's she going to face Dracula, the king of the vampires? When's she going to face Dracula? Because it wasn't... I was surprised by how light the tone in this episode was. Like, mm-hmm. They play up the jokes, and they never quite, like... I never felt scared. In the Hush episode, those guys
are
terrifying, and they're treated with a lot of gravitas. But Dracula, I kind of felt like everybody's kind of... making jokes and playing around. It's like, this guy should be able to kill you all, but let's take this a little more seriously.
Well, they had just pretty much taken down the initiative the season before, and it was very serious. There was some real major Buffy and Riley shenanigans going on.
Is the initiative the like monster army fighting group that are...
Yes,
I didn't mention
guys.
That, but in Hush... Buffy's boyfriend is, I mean, he's college age, so he's like part of a like monster fighting ROTC in secret. And then, I mean, that plays into the sort of tension of that episode that they both have these secrets that they're not talking about and plays into the theme of the show as far as not being able to talk. But I had to continue watching. So after Hush, I did watch an episode to sort of give myself a little place where, yes, now he knows that she's a slayer.
Right.
She knows that he's part of this military, so that's the initiative.
Yeah, the initiative is the military group there that on the college campus, because it's a Hellmouth. It's not like, oh, that's convenient. It's just that it happens also.
Right,
they're there
because
of the Hellmouth. So there's kind of a lot of drama that goes on at the end of the fourth season, And so this one, it comes back lighter, but the things that Dracula is saying to her are actually totally, totally heavy. And it is what propels the season forward, especially into the season that so many people hate, but it's honestly my favorite season, the dark season 6.
Okay.
But Dracula in this, it's light, gross enough. Riley's still there. It's so freaking annoying. I hate Riley. So much. But we start out with Buffy leaving bed to go hunting.
Yes.
And that is what she's doing. She just goes out to find some people to kick their ass and then goes back to bed. Which is awesome, I guess, if you can get away with it.
Yeah, it's like getting a late night jog and exhaust yourself. Yeah.
Out there, she meets Dracula. And not only does she meet Dracula, but Willow and Xander are wandering around, too.
Yeah, drinking coffee drinks in the middle of the night.
Well, you gotta stay awake.
It's college.
Hey, Buff, what's up?
You look like you just...
Get out of here, now.
Fine, but I was gonna give you a sip of my double mint mocha, but...
Behind you. Hi.
Nice. Look who's got a bad case of Dark Prince envy.
I have no interest in you. Leave us.
No, we're not going to leave you. And where'd you get that accent? Sesame Street? 1, 2, 3. 3 victims.
Xander, I'm pretty sure that's Dracula.
Wow, really? Hey, sorry, man. I was just joking around.
When Dracula does emerge from his delivery box, there's a sound drop that I've probably used it in this show because it is sort of like almost a parody of a... suspense theme. I guess at the time it was jarring, but then I sort of figured out the tone of this particular episode, and I was like, all right, well, that's on point.
Yeah, something about the sound and the orchestration that's done for the show, besides Nerf Herder doing the opening segment, any of the orchestrated parts throughout it were mostly synthesizers.
Okay.
Even though it sounds like strings, it's all string synth, things like that, because they weren't allowed to go into with a studio and with a small orchestra and record it. So for synthetic sounds, it's pretty great.
Yeah, I didn't realize Nerf Herder did the theme. They were famous
90s.
For the cover of Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal in the late 90s,
I believe. I did not know that.
I think that, no, you know what? I'm thinking of Alien Ant Farm. Nerf Herder was a
punk
band.
These are all words.
Punk.
That you're saying, and I don't know those words.
Okay, well, let's go back. Okay, so as far as like a cost-cutting measure, very much like Mark Snow scored most of the X-Files and was very heavy with the synthesizers, in this case, same deal. Also, as far as cost-cutting, there was a few conspicuous vampire kills that kind of happened off-camera, and I was like, that's okay, guys. Like, not even like a poof of dirt or like whatever emanates from when she
stabs. Which is
funny,
because you know someone could have just been off camera throwing it at people.
Just off camera kills. This is a quick, easy way to let's get to the next scene, let's save some money.
Right, this was a little bit more involved with the money on the Dracula, because Dracula is magical. We learn from Spike that he's no regular vampire. He likes tricks.
What can you tell me about Dracula?
Dracula, Ponzi bugger owes me £11 for one thing.
You know him?
Know him. We're old rivals. But then he got famous and forgot all about his foes. I'll tell you what. That glory hound's done more harm to vampires than any slayer. His story gets out, and suddenly everybody knows how to kill us.
Yep.
The mirror bit.
But he's not just a regular vampire. He has special powers, right?
Nothing but showy gypsy stuff.
But I'm out to find him before he gets another shot at her.
Tough talk, cowboy. But you're not going to catch him napping in a crypt. No, the Count has to have his luxury estate and his bug eaters and his special dirt, doesn't he?
Right, and he can, like, transubstantiate to not just bats, but, you know,
wolves,
whatever he chooses.
Whatever he feels, and mist, mostly.
Yeah, but that cemetery scene is really funny when he does turn into the bat and sort of swoop around them. Even Buffy's reaction is really funny to hearing that he's Dracula. I love that moment. That was really funny.
It's some great dialogue there. What ends up happening is our group now is going to fight Dracula. They convene at Giles' house. But Buffy seems to be under the thrall of Dracula, and Xander's acting like A weirdo.
He does have that mesmerism. Well, at this point, right, Xander's the first one to sort of like fall under a spell, at which point he turns into Renfield.
Right.
And he, it wasn't, I don't know, I was probably watching like an not HD version of this on Hulu, but I thought he just grabbed like a leaf from a tree.
The spider?
I didn't get a good look. I assumed it was a bug, and he's a bug eater.
But the thing is, they should all be thanking him because it seems like a very dangerous spider that he eats. So thank you for that, Xander.
Yeah, but I think I hate Xander. I don't like his character. I don't think he's particularly funny. And it really kind of bothered me that like this is one of the like, you know, mid-show seasons, and he still hasn't bothered to learn how to fight. Like, do they keep him around as vampire bait? Why is he there at all?
Xander's there for two reasons. One reason is because when they made the Super Buffy at the end of season four, I believe it's the end of season four, he is kind of like the heart of the group.
Yeah.
So that's what he's there for. Also because...
That's a very generous way to describe him. If you remember Captain Planet, the like kid who couldn't do shit, he was the heart.
Well, that's what Xander is being right there. And then also what he provides is some great military knowledge, because one time on Halloween, they all got changed into their costumes and Xander was an army man. So he retained all the knowledge he learned from being an army man.
That sounds useful.
And it actually is. So he can read blueprints, things like that. Also later, he becomes really good at skilled work, like with his hands and stuff, and he makes Buffy's weapons and trunks and things like that.
Now that's
something. He also fixes the windows and tables, which they break all the time. So he's very useful. You just don't know it yet.
Okay. I thought he was just maybe filling out the color palette with his Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah, Xander's probably like the least good character. Definitely. Buffy, Spike, way, way down is Xander. He does give us that great line.
Well, I think we have Dracula factoids.
Lucky name, that's enough to fight the Dark Master. Bader.
That's so funny. You can't tell me you didn't laugh when that happened.
Nice wordplay, Joss Whedon.
When we finally discover where does Dracula live, he lives in this castle that we've never seen before in all of Sunnydale.
It was very Scooby-Doo, and I think they even address it in that way. Yeah. They're like, gosh, I never realized it was a castle in Sunnydale.
Exactly. So stupid Riley is walking around with Giles, and they go searching for Dracula. Even though Spike told stupid Riley, don't do that. But then Riley, I hate when he threatens Spike. It really bothers me because he's such a loser. He's such like a lame-o. But anyway, Giles and stupid Riley go to the castle. Don't even knock. Just wander right in.
As you do.
And are greeted by those weird sisters, the three sisters.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was... The structure of this episode very much plays out like Bram Stoker's Dracula in terms of, you know, the three vampires and the mesmerism and sort of having Xander... play his Renfield. Yeah, I enjoyed that part. That was kind of a nod to, like, you know, old school Universal monsters. And yeah, I like that a lot.
Did you not like this episode?
Overall, I did. It took a lot of getting used to. By the very end, I actually did really like the sort of epilogue where Buffy's on to Dracula's tricks. And that sort of also informs that, yes, he is Dracula, but they've faced the end of the world at this point. Like, they are, you know, they're with it. They know what they're doing. Dracula is just another vampire, I guess. So when he, like, you know, fades to dirt and then sort of smokes up to, like, you know, reestablish himself, and she's just there waiting, knowing that, like, yeah, we've all watched movies.
Right.
Yeah, we know you're going to try and come back. And
that's
so, yeah,
always
I like
nice.
That. And then yeah, I think even off camera, she's like, I'm still here, you know. I was going to ask you why she isn't, I guess that sort of speaks to her character and sort of the bigger picture, but that she is unaffected. I mean, it seems like Dracula only has hold on her moment to moment when he is like in the midst of mesmerizing her.
Right.
But she seems to be able to break the spell pretty effectively when she chooses.
Because she's the Slayer.
All right.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know.
What did you think about the very end? We're introduced to somebody at the very end. Maybe it doesn't mean anything to you. There's a character literally at the very end. And I remember watching the show on TV going, what? Like that. Michelle Trachtenberg is her sister, but she never had a sister. In any of those other episodes we watched, did she have a sister?
I didn't realize this is the first appearance of the sister.
Yeah, this is the first Dawn episode.
Oh, all right. Well, that I think I knew that her sister kind of emerges fully flushed out as a human being, teenager, no less.
Yeah.
But I didn't know when that happened, so I didn't realize that this was the first appearance of her sister.
This is the very first episode.
Okay. I
remember yelling at the TV, like, what? What just happened?
It's a little Days of Our Lives in terms of like, oh, your sister who's been in a coma all these years, she's now a teenager.
It's funny that you should say that, because around this time I was actually watching Days of Our Lives. And they changed this character, Belle, out one time. And literally she went into the shower and was one person. And then she like sticks her head out of the shower to talk to like Brady or something. And it's a whole different person. I yelled at the TV then too. Like,
that's
what?
That's hilarious.
I apparently yelled at the TV a lot.
I wouldn't be surprised if Joss Whedon had like a certain amount of soap opera background, just as far as absorbing it. Yeah, I don't know. He plays on melodramatic themes from time to time, and in this case, like introducing a character from scratch is kind of ballsy.
It was something.
So that'll wrap it up for this episode on Buffy. A word to the listeners. So it's good news and bad news. I've been accepted to grad school, and that's a huge deal for me. It's been a long time coming. That said, I'm not going to be able to spend as much time as I can and want on the show. So that said, Mindy's going to be keeping the fire lit, and our schedule is going to change a little bit. It's going to be moving towards closer to one episode a month, and we're going to be maintaining Patreon episodes as well. But there will be less of the Rance Macabre. It's kind of we've hit that point where the amount of time it takes to do the show makes it difficult to have lives elsewhere.
It's true. It's true. And that especially the first semester of grad school is killer.
Yeah.
You know, I did that 2 years ago and it's rough. So it's okay, because I didn't want to have a crappier show. I'd rather just have one really good episode than a bunch of, you know, like...
We've got standards to maintain. We've set a pretty, I mean, well, as it turns out, a pretty impossible pace.
And now you have even better library access, too. Get excited about that.
Yeah, that'll be cool. So, yeah, so we're, you know, we're not going away. We're just, we're going to be, you know, putting up fewer shows. But that said, make sure you're subscribed, so when the shows do come out, they go right to your phone, iPod, whatever you're listening to it on. Stitcher, I don't.
And be sure to check us out on Patreon, because we're keeping that up as well.
Yep.
So it's patreon.com/rancemacabre.
Yep. And on social media, we are at Rance Macabre on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And our email is therancemacabre@gmail.com. And the website is therancemacabre.com. And yeah, we'll be doing updates. We'll continue to participate on Twitter and Facebook. Yeah. So keep in touch that way.
Because it's always good to tweet during class.
That'll do it for me. So long for now. This is Darren signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.